You have found writing when inspiration fails you. If you are in the wrong place, stay.
Please
stay. I am Kelly Swales. I'll be your moderator. I'll let these fine gentlemen introduce themselves. And as they do so, I want them to answer the question, what is your favorite place to write and the ideal conditions for which you like to do so?
Hi, I'm Brad Bollier. I'm an author of epic fantasy. I have two books out in a trilogy from Nightshade Books. The first one, The Winds of Kalakovo, came out last year, April. The second one, The Straits of Galahesh, came out this year, April, and naturally next year will be the third. I write sci-fi and fantasy, but in novel form, mostly epic fantasy. I also run, along with this gentleman, a podcast called Speculate, and you can find it at speculatesf.com. And we talk about writing technique. We interview authors. We have editors and artists on sometimes to talk about the industry, and we review books as well. So give that a look-see.
Mm-hmm. What's your favorite place to write in your ideal conditions?
Yeah, so I traveled for a long time and still do for a living. So I would travel on planes, I would be in airports, it'd be really loud. And so I didn't mean to, but it just, I don't care where I write. And in fact, now I work out of the home mostly. I still travel a little bit. But I actually just like to get variation, frankly. I feel kind of stagnant if I write in the same place for too long. So I don't so much care about the conditions, but I care to change things up just to keep things a little bit fresher.
Cool. Hi, everyone. My name is Gregory Wilson. You've seen all of us. I feel like you're like, yes, we've heard all these things before. I'm an associate professor of English at St. John's University in Queens. I teach courses in fantasy, science fiction, creative writing, among others. And I am also a writer. My first novel, The Third Sign, came out a couple of years ago. Next two are being shopped. I'm working on a fourth, which is actually going to be going through the ringer, along with some other books at Wellspring Workshop, which is an invite-only novel writing workshop coordinated by this gentleman on my left. Yes, and also involving Kelly, who is on the far end of the table. I am co-editing an anthology on speculative fiction and politics with Hugo nominee John Helfers, who is a member of the symposium here. I have a short story out in an anthology called When the Villain Comes Home, which is edited by Ed Greenwood and Gabriela Harboway and just came out this month. I've been asked to say that I am running low on some of these books, so if you want to get one, this is coming close to the end of your time since this is the fourth day of the con. And as far as where I like to write, it's an interesting question because it's kind of shifted over the years. I used to think that my favorite place to write was in my office because, you know, it's an office and it's where people write. What I've discovered is that my office is also the place where people surf the internet. It's also the place where people read. It's also the place where people stare off into space idly. And so,
other people or you?
By other people, I mean me. I am the other. And so one of the things that I've discovered, I totally agree with Brad, is variation is important. I sometimes find that the best place to write is when I can go out and go to a Starbucks or a restaurant or someplace that has, you know, no likely internet access, and I shut off my phone, and I can just sort of sit down and write. And I find that that's probably the most important thing, is to make sure that, and I assume we'll talk about this quite a bit today at the panel, whatever you do, that you manage to actually get words on the page and pages on the screen and material in the file of the manuscript that you're working on, so that you don't sort of drift off into somewhere else. And so the best circumstances involve variation and not necessarily access to shiny, distracting things.
Right. Excellent. I think the first thing what I want to talk about is, I mean, the title of the panel is When Inspiration Fails You, but basically I think what we're talking about is writer's block. It's a fancy way of saying that. So I think I want the panelists to define writer's block for them, because I think it means different things for different people. For me, writer's block, you know what, I will follow your suggestion, or follow your comments, because I have a very firm belief on writer's block.
Well, I mean, I know what other people think writer's block is, but I haven't really experienced it, or if I have, it hasn't been for very long. I've long since fallen into a pattern of writing 1 hour every day. rain or shine. I just get that time in, the people call it butt in chair. Sit down at your computer and get something done. Sometimes it's not very productive, and I don't get a lot done. So there's that. I think once you, if you can start to build a habit, then that will train your mind to slip into writing mode faster as time goes on. So that's one thing. And then I think I have come to dead ends in my story where I'm like, I have no idea where I'm going with this thing. At first, the first few times that that happened to me, I wrote over it, and it was a huge mistake. I ended up ruining a novel because of it. And it was just, you know, beginners not knowing any better. And now I've gotten really good, I think, at recognizing when I'm starting to go off the track, because I can't see ahead of myself very well in terms of the plot, and I know I'm going to hit a dead end. Sometimes I let myself go down that path anyway, because sometimes you can find really interesting ways out of those problems. So I don't backtrack immediately when I sense that's going on. I kind of play around with it a little bit, and then if I feel like I need to, I'll go back. But if I do feel that, I'll backtrack until the point where I feel like it's good. You know, it feels the plot's going well, and that's the spot where I've taken the wrong turn. And then I'll re-envision where I'm headed and start over again. And that usually gets me back on track. So those are two little bits of advice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. A lot of what I run into, I seldom run into something where I just can't write anything and where I'm just sort of staring, you know, at a blank, the blinking cursor on the white screen. I usually don't run into that problem. I have, however, run into problems where, and this is something which I think is actually directly relevant to the panel, where you're going along and you're going along, and then almost as if you're driving a car through mud, everything slows way, way down. And it's more that as I'm reading, as I'm writing, I always have a tendency to kind of in my mind be sort of reading as I'm writing and kind of imagining what it sounds like. I don't do what some writers do, which is to read every sentence after I write it, because that way lies madness, it seems to me. But I do, you know, go through these, you know, I'll go through and then I'll sometimes, there will be times when I'll stop and I'll kind of read a couple of sentences to see if I can hear the flow, but I'm always in my mind kind of doing that. And there'll be stages where it will slow way down and I'll feel like what I'm reading and I'm like, what is, no, what? That doesn't, no. And in the past, when I was first starting out, I would have a tendency to let the car driving through the mud just stop completely and say, you know, I don't know what's going on. I've clearly lost it. Inspiration has failed me. And the problem, what I would usually do in that circumstance is sometimes I would sort of walk away from it. But the problem is I would often not go back to it. And the reason was I felt, well, once you get the car stuck in the mud, I guess that's it. But that's not it, right? Like, if you get the car stuck in the mud, you don't just leave the car and say, well, I guess that's the end of that. I'll have to go get a new car. You don't do that. You know, you have to think of new ways to get the car out of the mud. And part of that involves looking at the problem from a different angle. Part of that may involve getting up and leaving. But as you're leaving, you're still thinking in your mind, I wonder how I might go about that. You may set some kind of limit for yourself or say, I'm gonna go downstairs. I'm going to, you know, make myself a cup of tea, a coffee or something. I'm going to kind of relax for a minute. I'm going to go out and, you know, run the dog around the yard or something like that and not think about it. And then say a half hour in, you know, an hour in, something like that. Come back and then see the way that things present themselves to me in a new light. So one of the things that I had to learn was not giving up totally once the car had gotten into the mud. Early on in my career, I was the best beginner and not ender of novels that you ever saw. Like, you know, Nobel Prize winning opening, like, so they were great, and then they stopped because the car hit the mud, and I said, well, if it's not free and easy all the way through 120,000 words, clearly it's not worth it. And that's completely untrue. Every writer, I think, will tell you, I can't imagine a single writer who sat down and said 120,000 words of pure inspiration without any self-doubt. In fact, I can pretty much guarantee that is not the case. So there are stages, there are moments where writing is much less like a fanciful work of you know, pure joy, and where
and
it's
muses just, by and, your and, side
yes,
at all
it's
times.
Harps and playing and violins. Yeah, it's usually there are some moments where you feel really good and you feel just your fingers are just flying on the keyboard and you feel amazing. And there are other moments where it's a slog. The key, I think, to sort of being wise about writing is recognizing that the moments of slog are just as critical to the process as the moments of joy and inspiration, and you need to get through that slog and trust that you will eventually get back to the joy and inspiration. So a lot of getting through writer's block is not letting the block become a wall over which I choose never to go.
Right. I think a big thing for me, and I have a very, very, very firm opinion on this, which you are about to hear, writer's block does not exist. It does not exist. Writer's block is other things masked as writer's block, okay? There's no such thing. These guys have talked about, you know, like, they've recognized what writer's block is for them in certain situations. We've touched on knowing or recognizing when it's gone off the rails. It's like you've stopped. It's like, well, maybe something's not right with the manuscript. I've screwed up the plot. I've done this. I've done that. I think Greg makes an absolutely vital point in that a huge part of becoming a professional writer is finishing what you write. You don't want to do that at the expense of, like Brad said, you don't want to do that at the expense of ruining your novel. But you got to finish. And you do that by getting back on the rails. So how do you guys, you've talked about when you recognize how when you have to recalibrate, you know, because it has slowed down, you've hit the mud, you've kind of screeched to a halt a little bit. Mm-hmm. How do you recalibrate? How do you get back on track? You talked a little bit about stepping away, getting a little bit of exercise. Are there certain things that you guys like to do? Because personally, I like to knit. That's how I recalibrate. If I've hit the rails, I'm like, I'll give myself permission to take a few days off. I knit. Knitting is very zen. It occupies a part of your brain that doesn't, and while you're knitting, you can be thinking about other things. Mowing the yard is a good thing for me, too. Getting a little bit of exercise is, I think, key. What do you guys do to recalibrate? So you've talked about when you know when you need to. What do you do to do that?
Well, I want to say two things. First of all, and you may have heard me talk about this before, I try to spend a lot of time on the world. I mean, I write in secondary worlds, first of all, but even with something urban fantasy that I write in short fiction or near future sci-fi, whatever, I try to spend a lot of time on the world or the technology or the magic, and I mean a lot of time, so that I understand the underpinnings of this place and the cultures and the people, and then the characters are born from those things. And then their political bent, their religious beliefs, on and on, are kind of advised by those things. They don't necessarily fall in line with everything that their people believe, that type of thing. But you know, they advise who they are. They grew up in that environment, so that helps me to figure out, you know, what they would do in any given situation. You know, I'm kind of distilling upward towards character from world to culture to character, and then now you have something that you can. It's internally consistent. You understand them much better, and so it'll help to guide you. And so, as if I again when I hit kind of those roadblock times, then I take a step back. I allow myself a couple of days, or however long it takes. I still spend my 1 hour a day, but sometimes that 1 hour is brainstorming time. This is not at the beginning of the novel now. I'm well into it. But I personally cannot see the entire novel. I can't plot everything out. I just, there's so many things that come to me later on that are critical, and they're cool, you know, and they're awesome parts of the plot and stuff, and it's you just can't get it all up front. And when you get to the later parts of the novel, some of that will cycle back to the beginning. You know your characters a lot better, you know what's gonna happen to the plot, so you can go back and layer in some foreshadowing. So I can't do that stuff. So I will hit roadblocks, and I'm okay with that. And you should be too. So the one of the best pieces of advice, I use it over and over and over again, and it's such a simple thing. I went to Orson Scott Card's literary boot camp, and he gives this talk at different places. Not so much anymore. He used to do it more, but it's called 1,000 Ideas in an Hour. And this talk is about it's about creativity a little bit, how to brainstorm in some ways. And the notion is this: when you're trying to think of something, whatever it is, some idea, you just start playing with it. You ask questions: who, where, when, why. You keep asking questions. You go down a trail, a path, until you find something that you like. And here's the key: when you're thinking of these things, the first couple of things will be the cliches, There'll be the easy things. There'll be the stuff that comes to everybody's mind first, right? And it's when you get to the fourth or fifth or sixth one and you go, or, oh, wow, or, oh, that's awesome. You know, and you've heard this. You've heard people talk about stuff like an idea for a book. I use this for first lines a lot, too. There's a book opening, and I forget the book. And it starts out, I went to Iraq a soldier, and I came back a vampire.
Yeah.
Right? And so look at everybody's reactions. It's like, oh, wow, you know, a little jolt. So that's what you're looking for with these ideas, that little, like, ah, cool, something that you're excited about, because that gets you excited about your world, your characters, the plot, you know, whatever you're kind of working on right now. And that helps to just move things along, and it gets you excited. It makes the whole book better.
Mm-hmm. I'm a big believer in breaking massive projects down into bite-sized portions, in part because I think that one of the reasons that 90% of the people you'll run into who find out that you're a writer will say, oh, I had an idea for a book, or I've got this great idea for a book, or I've got this great idea for a story or a novel. Of that 90%, 90% will never write it. And the reason is that those 90% of people may have a great idea. And it's an idea which, if they cannot execute in its full form, they say, I'm never going to get there, so why even bother to begin? Because if you sit down and think about it, 120,000 words is a lot of words. 80, 90, the minimum for, you know, something in our field is generally around 80,000 words if you're writing for the adult market. If it's YA, it's less than that. But still, I mean, even YA, 60, 70, it's a lot of words that we're talking about here. And if you think about it that way, if you think, I'm going to write the equivalent of the Notre Dame Cathedral for me. You know, I mean, think about what it would have been like if they had said, and I like to use this example of people working in the medieval period to build these cathedrals that they knew they would never complete, that their daughters or sons, you know, I shouldn't say daughters, their sons would have to complete, and they would never see the end of. If they had sat there and said, I'm never going to finish this, I guarantee the majority of them would not have started. What did they take inspiration from? They took inspiration from the portion of the cathedral they completed. They took inspiration from the the arches that they had built. They took inspiration from the tower that they had finished, right? And that, in the same way, is something that you can think about on a smaller scale with your writing, which is to say, you're not going to write 100, 120,000 words in a day. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen in a month unless you're doing NaNoWriMo, which is a very sort of different kind of animal.
There's most
of the
panel,
time,
yeah.
Yeah, different panel. Most of the time, it's going to take you, at the minimum, a few months to get something like this done, and usually somewhat longer than that. So the way to think about it, that I try to think about it, is breaking it down into these reasonable portions where you say, if I can write, let's say, 5 or 6 manuscript pages a day for 5 days a week, or if I can write, you know, if I can get through 3,000 words today, or if I can get through, you know, 6,000 words in this given period of time. That's manageable. That's reasonable. You know, I can get through a 15-page chapter, which is roughly about, you know, 3,500 words, something like that. And I can get through that in a few days, and I can feel good about it when I'm done, and I can say this is completed, and that part of the cathedral has been put into place, right? And by doing that, and by breaking it down into these bite-sized portions, it doesn't become something which is quite that overwhelming. I think for some authors, if you would talk to them and they would look back on it and think about how many hundreds of thousands of words we've written over our career, it'd be like, oh my God, if anyone had told us this, no, I would not do this. So you don't think about it in those terms. You think about it in these much sort of smaller portions. One of the other things that I do, which is very helpful to me, is I do actually put together an outline. I didn't used to do that, but I found that an outline is very helpful in several respects. But there's a caveat to this outline, which we'll talk about in a minute. The reason an outline for me is good is because, especially when I'm writing something that's novel length, and especially if I'm writing a work of, let's say, epic fantasy, there are, for me, way too many moving parts to keep in my head all at the same time. And I'm fairly good. I have a fairly good memory, and I'm fairly good at sort of remembering where things go, but I'm not so good at remembering where things go in precisely the order I wanted them to. And that creates slippage, right? If I start saying that so-and-so has blue eyes instead of green eyes by chapter 4, that person may well be blind by chapter 15. You know, like, I need to make sure that I'm kind of on top of it all the way through. And so one of the things that the outline does for me is it gives me a sense of the arc. An arc of a series, if I'm writing a trilogy, and then the arc of the individual book that I'm working on within that trilogy. My outlines, though, are not sort of Roman numeral A, number one, you know, like they're not that bullet point sort of official, right, or standard. They tend to be paragraph long, almost narrative descriptions of what's happening within that paragraph, the general sense of what goes on, a basic plot summary, and some of the basic information about the characters that I will expect to encounter within that chapter. There's two benefits to this method. The first benefit is that on a practical level, there will be times later on in your career where you will submit manuscripts and you will sometimes be asked for, from agents or publishers, a chapter by chapter synopsis or outline. And if you've done that ahead of time, that's less work that you have to do now, right? The second benefit, and I think this is the biggest one, is that it gives me the sense that if I do lose my way, if the car does get stuck in the mud in chapter five, at some point, I say to myself, at some point, self, you had figured out how to get the car from point A to point B without getting stuck in the mud, and this proves it to you. And I can go back to that outline and go, okay, I know the basic idea of the way the plot's going to operate. And it takes very little time to write a paragraph as opposed to, you know, however many thousands of words goes into a specific chapter. The only caveat I want to give you about the outline, outline doesn't work for everybody, but I find it works very well for me. The only caveat is it cannot be set in stone. It cannot be something that you tie around your neck and say, I can't ever leave this behind. Because then what Brad is talking about, you'll run into where you'll say, this is a really cool idea, but I can't follow it because my outline says, you know, you are in charge of the outline, okay? You're in charge of your manuscript. So you need to be willing to shift that outline, to make adjustments to it, to sort of, you know, take a left turn where you had thought you would take a right. You need to be willing to take detours. But having that initial thing, which didn't take as long to put together, where I had a sense of the tone and the character structure and the plot in each of these chapters, having that is enormously helpful to me to kind of keep me on track when I'm starting to doubt, am I actually ever going to get this thing done? So for me, outlines and bite-sized portions are important.
Yeah, absolutely. Great points.
Well,
let's talk a little bit about having firm rules for yourself and knowing when to back off a little bit. I think a big key, like Brad touched on this a little bit at the beginning, was having like a schedule every day. Every day you write for an hour, every day you get 1,000 words. And that's about my pace too. I can write, if I'm in really good form, I can get 1,200 words in an hour. But 1,000 words in an hour is about typical. But it's important to always have that time to do that. What do you guys do for yourself to give yourself that firm rule? Like, how do you make it so that you don't find other things to fill your time with? I guess. Do you know what I mean? It's like, mm-hmm. I'm talking about self-discipline and how it applies, you know, so.
Well, part of that is the schedule. I mean, some people have crazy schedules, but, you know, 1 hour a day, I mean, even 45 minutes. Sometimes it takes a while to get into the mode, right?
Yeah.
You sit down and you're not ready to just start tapping away. So one of the things I do besides that, I mean, I have a couple of kids, wife, you know, that I like to see once in a while. And I think they like to see me. So I kind of wait for the kids to go to bed. And so, you know, nighttime is my time. So it's a pretty set schedule. But what you can do is start thinking about what you're writing earlier in the day, you know, in the shower, on the drive, you know, maybe turn the music down a little bit when you're getting to going to work and coming back, and just ponder what came before, ponder, you know, some problems that you see ahead, brainstorm new ideas if you're getting towards the end of your current project. And that helps me to slip into writing mode a little bit faster. Sometimes my mind is just so busy from the day, it's hard to get into that mode. So prepping yourself is helpful.
Yeah, I totally agree with that idea about thinking about writing before you're actually sitting down at the keyboard. I find that a lot of beginning writer students in my classes in particular will have this thought that they have X amount of time to write, and so they will literally begin writing, by which they mean think for the first time about the subject when they sit down in front of their computer. And this is a bad idea. It takes your brain a little bit of a while to kind of get, you know, the engine running a little bit and sort of be in the mode that's necessary. And sometimes if you've left yourself an hour, let's say, and it takes you 20, 25 minutes to get into that environment, then, you know, you got 35 minutes left, and then you're supposedly done. And so that can be very inefficient. So I think it's very important to be thinking about stuff throughout the day. It's very important, in my view, to be carrying something like a notebook or your smartphone or something that you may have on you so that you can jot down a few notes as they come to you. I'm a college professor, is my day job, and so I have the opportunity to have schedules with rises and falls, right? And between classes and between grading, you know, binges and things like that, there will be moments where I'll have a little bit of downtime, and those are the times when I'm able to scribble some notes, get some bits of information, and then when I get longer chunks of time, that's when I'm actually able to sit down and write. I do want to say one thing about the importance of rules, because I totally agree that it's important to try to keep yourself on task, but at the beginning of this year, I had this thought that I had finally decided I was going to sort of embark on a new way of writing, and that was that I was without fail every day going to write a certain percentage of words, and if I didn't get that percentage of words, I'm not talking about time so much now, but a certain number of words, that there was going to be a problem. And if I write X amount of words every day, this amount of days per week, blah, 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 then I will have a novel by X point, and then, you know, and it all sounds so wonderful in the vista of January 1st when you're making your New Year's resolutions and you know that this
isn't... And you're coming off like the pound cake coma.
Yeah. And this isn't starting till tomorrow. So, like, by tomorrow, I am ready to go, you know, and that first day is great because, you know, you haven't started actually writing. So what I discovered was, and I'm this part I'm really very serious about because it was kind of a revelation to me. You have to be gentle with yourself also. I also have a four-year-old daughter. I also have a wife. I like seeing them. I think they like seeing me. I also have a full-time job as a college professor. I also review theater shows in the city. I have a lot of stuff that's going on, and those things are not, none of those things are recreation. Music is important to me. It is not something that I'm like, well, it's just kind of a hobby. No, it's very important. In fact, it stimulates my creative, juices in other ways that just writing and reading would not do. I am not and have never been the kind of person that can only single-mindedly do one thing forever. I can't do that. I need to be able to do other things or I will simply shut down. It's just the way that I'm built. And what I did at the beginning of the year when this plan of mine in the, you know, pound cake coma was such a great idea was I said, this is what I'm going to do. And when I found that it wasn't happening because things went wrong with the house that we had just bought and because my daughter had gotten very sick, not like hospital sick, but, you know, we had to take care of her for a couple of weeks while she was recuperating. And, you know, my dog was having medical trouble and I had to run her back and forth to the vet and the car broke down. Life happened, right? And life happens to all of us. What I did for a while there was I beat the hell out of myself for not having stuck with this January 1st resolute. You should have done this, and you're writing all the time, and you've got articles for the CIFL Bulletin, and you've got this, and you're, and how dare you? And all of a sudden, I heard my parents' voice, the perfectionist part. I love my parents, but the perfectionist part, the part that said, you have a gift, and don't waste it. And I saw that voice lecturing me again. That, folks, is extraordinarily dangerous because what that does to you is gives you this feeling that you are not ever going to measure up and you're not going to achieve and you're not going to accomplish. And the truth is that every single one of us at some point has had a doubt as to whether we will be able to continue a career in this profession because it's difficult to do. So I want to encourage you. I agree with everything Brad has said. I agree with what Kelly said. You do need to be firm. You do need to keep on track, butt in seat, fingers on keys. Totally agree. But you also need to be gentle with yourself when these things do not work out perfectly and trust that you will eventually circle back around to the proper path. And I really think that's important because at the beginning of the year, I would have had a different approach to this than I do now. And I want to encourage you, you are not the only ones who have doubted yourselves before. So don't let that stop you. You will get back on track. Be gentle to yourself.
Yes, right. I have a little ticky mark under here. Firm rules for yourself, but forgive yourself your your failures. That's absolutely vitally key. I can't speak for the other panelists, but I tend to have like a really vicious it's kind of like an abusive cycle in my head where it's like if I don't accomplish like my goals for like 3 days in a row, it's like, God, what are you doing? Why are you so horrible? Yep. Why can't you just do this simple thing? This is not a hard thing to do. And that's like a very, very dangerous cycle to get into because you're not in a really great frame of mind to, you're not empowering yourself. Right. You're cutting yourself down and you want to avoid that if at all possible. I want to kind of mention that I've got a few things. They made really great points. Think about your writing throughout the day so that when you do sit down, it's more, you're ready to go. it's more ready to go. I still need a little ease in time. It's usually, you know, it's usually about 15 minutes. I set a timer, and it's like, once the timer dings, then that's it. There's no more Facebook. We're writing now. A big trick I've learned over the years is to leave yourself at a cliffhanger spot. Several years ago gave me some really brilliant advice, and her advice was write what makes you want to write more. And that's probably some of the most brilliant advice I've ever been given. And for me, I translated that into giving myself a cliffhanger. If I'm going and I think this is a great writing session, I've gotten 1,200 words, I am awesome. I know exactly what happens next. Not only that, I know what happens for the next 4,000 words. This is brilliant. I'm going to stop for today. And then that's it. I mean, I could easily sit down and write those 4,000 words, but then it's done. You know, so the next day I come back, I'm like, I still know where I'm going. I know what happens next. Mm-hmm. You know, so I've got my next 3 days of writing completely planned out. And I'm excited to get back to it. I can't wait. I cannot wait to get back to the computer tomorrow night. This is awesome. So I think that would be my biggest piece of advice to, like, kind of find the inspiration going. Like, don't, like, leave yourself at a cliffhanger. Leave yourself wanting to write more. And find that spot. It doesn't always happen every night, but if you can find your spot there, then it's awesome. Let's see. I'm recalibrating.
Let me throw out a couple things.
Yes.
While you're doing that. So we talked about, you know, thinking about your writing during the day. One of the things, and Greg mentioned a little journal. One of my favorite pieces of advice is, again, from Orson Scott Card. He wrote a book called How to Write Science Fiction and Fantasy, I believe it's called. He also wrote Characters and Viewpoint, which is also a very good book. And I think it was in the first one, How to Write Science Fiction and Fantasy, where he talked about this. He calls it an idea net. We, as human beings, we get something like 6 million bits of information every second, and our brain is really good at, like, sifting that out and taking out the bits that are important, right, that you should pay attention to, that you want to pay attention to. Just like that, you get information from people, from radio, from TV, from just thinking about your past, where you're going, hopes, dreams, whatever. You get ideas, and if you don't capture them, they slip by, right? And so the idea of the idea net is that you want to cultivate your mind so that when things, you know, what we just talked about a little bit ago, like, oh, that's cool. A lot of times you just forget about that stuff, right? It's like here and it's gone. It doesn't make it to long-term memory. Well, train yourself in short-term memory to get it, and you'll get better at getting long-term about that stuff. But capture those ideas and, you know, jot them down. At the workshop for Orson Scott Card's Boot Camp and Writers of the Future, they both do this trick where you write a short story in one day. Seems very difficult at first, but it's actually a very liberating experience to write a short story in that amount of time, because it tells you that you can do that. You have, after you've done that once, you have no excuses not to write and you know, finish what you write. But the technique that they have you do is, among other things, go out and talk to people, interview people. At Writers of the Future, we weren't allowed to tell them why we were talking to them. We were just supposed to strike up a conversation. At Literary Boot Camp, we were supposed to tell them. It doesn't really matter. The point is this. When you talk to people, you will eventually, inevitably find even random strangers. You just start talking to them. You'll find something interesting about them. You know, where they work, what they've done, who they know. What they study, it doesn't matter. Something will come, and you'll be like, oh, "Wow, that's kind of cool. I never really thought about that." Those are little sparks of inspiration that can help you. And you, as you start getting better at thinking about stories, those will be like those fireworks that go, they'll spawn off other ideas. Another great source for me personally is NPR. I listen to NPR in the car, and they have, you know, they have great radio articles that go into a good amount of detail on different subjects and random subjects. You know, some politics, some science, some human interest, and I like that it just kind of jumps around because that helps me with creativity. So as those things come, I've gotten much better at creating my idea net and then using it to better effect.
The BBC World Service, I have satellite radio in my car, and the BBC World Service is my equivalent of that because they have these sort of long approaches to it, and that's also helpful to get me out of just an American cultural context and start looking at it, my God, a world culture context, who knew, you know, and then actually focusing on that as part of the idea net. The other thing I want to encourage people to do, too, is to look to other sources of creative inspiration and not necessarily just writing. I am an unabashed fanboy of Cirque du Soleil. I love Cirque du Soleil. I love watching specials on Cirque du Soleil. I love going to Cirque du Soleil. I know that it's often hokey. I don't know why people spin around in hamster balls with some countertenor yelling, oh, I don't know why. Only French Canadians maybe truly understand in Montreal where it's from. There's a certain kind of creative authority that I love about the way that Cirque du Soleil puts its work together. And one of the things that's interesting about it is that you have various aspects of creativity coming in at once, right? You have, obviously, creativity that comes through athletic achievement. And that's not just strength. That's also artistry. It's about how you present something in a way that looks and seems aesthetically beautiful to us. The way that that ties together with the music. The way that it can tie together with a story, even though it's an implied story. You know, you don't have a lot of narration going on in Cirque du Soleil, but you very much have, in most of these productions, some kind of a sort of through line that you can follow. And I find enormous inspiration in thinking and just watching all of those things kind of come together and kind of picking out bits. For instance, one Cirque du Soleil, probably, I don't know what it was, 5 or 6 years ago, and I don't remember which one, involves this creature falling from the sky and falls into the stage, and then there are all these little creatures that this creature with wings meets. I was so amazed by that I wrote a book called Icarus, in which a character with wings falls into the heart of a dormant volcano. And the story really is about on this other planet, and it's about what happens when these two characters meet. It's told in alternating first-person perspectives. There is sort of dialect involved and things like that. But that was directly came out of, and my wife was with me at the time when it came out, I was just, you know, this would be awesome because this thing would be in the volcano. And she said, yeah, I'm going to have to let you write this down, aren't I? And I said, yes, yes, you will. And it was enormously inspirational to me. And so I want to encourage you to think about that, going to a museum, going to a show, going to, if you can afford to see a classical music concert, even at a regional concert, that's great. If you can't do that and you want to go see a band playing in a small club, I can tell you that's very cheap. I know, because I play in the band. You know, that's very useful as well. So drawing in this idea net widely, not just in writing, and all, not just reading, and by the way, not just reading also within your subgenre, but reading widely too, but also being willing to take inspiration from music, from dance, from art, from visual arts. All of these things can contribute to the font of creative work that you can then draw from.
Absolutely, absolutely. I want to talk about fear masquerading as writer's block. I think it's something that we've not really touched on, and I think it's a huge contributor to that term. You know, it's like, I don't know what to write, I don't know what to do. It's a big belief of mine that writer's block is actually fear. You're either afraid to let people read your stuff, or you're afraid that you can't finish it, or you're afraid that you're no good, or you're afraid that you've done everything completely and horribly wrong, so you just stop. And I want to talk a little bit about how the panelists sort of overcome that. Like, recognize that and overcome that.
Let me jump in. Yeah. Well, let me jump in on that first. I absolutely.
Brad's like, I have no fear. What do you mean?
Yeah. Oh, sure. Me. Got fear everything. I think that's absolutely 100% true. That is mostly writer's block is kind of fear. Am I going to get this restarted again? The actual writer's block, not sort of writer's slowdown, but the I don't know what to do next. The thing to do when you are afraid of something is to identify what the something actually is. It is very seldom the dark alley that you're afraid of. It is the unknown. It is the what happens when I encounter whatever it might be. And your mind will jump to the worst possible conclusion. What is down the alley? Not some nice person who's going to say, oh, sure, this is the way to get to the street you're looking for, but some horrible serial killer who's going to, you know, kill you and take all of your stuff and run away and then kill your family. That's the boogeyman in the closet, right? Because we construct fear. It is a human construction. It is what we do. And part of it is done for very good reasons, because you wanted to be afraid of the things that would kill you. That's how our ancestors made it, you know, by running away from the big bad things that would kill them. The problem is that when fear becomes greater than the source that it's really coming from, that's when it starts to dominate you. That's when it becomes too powerful. So the question is, fear of what? And in the case of writer's block, for me, as I say, I fortunately don't run into this part of it too much, but that sort of perfectionist voice that I was talking about, the why aren't you doing this better, that's what I'm afraid of. I am most afraid of, I will say in my little therapy session here, I am most afraid of letting other people down.
Yeah.
I have always been most afraid of letting other people down. And by extension, I guess, letting myself down. But mostly, letting other people down. That is a very dangerous fear, because you can't let your life be ruled by what other people will or won't think.
Right.
Ultimately, that fear has to be, if not removed, has to be put in its proper place, which
is
to say,
the
fear of disapproval, the fear that they're going to call your bluff, the fear that, see, you weren't that good after all. And that's not just, that means that I'm a bad person. It means that they think I'm a bad person because I didn't get this thing done. One of the best ways to overcome that fear is to build a community of people who can support you in those moments. For instance, these two people are very good friends of mine, and one of the great things that we have in common in the symposium and elsewhere is that we're able to call each other up. Kelly and I have done this. Brad and I have talked to each other on numerous occasions about things going on in our writing careers and can sort of say, so I'm okay, right? Like, yes, you're not terrible. Okay, neither of us are terrible. No, we're not, okay. That's really important, because you need your peers, people that you respect, not just, you know, your mom or your dad or your brother or sister or your husband or wife. Those are very valuable people to have, but you really need people who are going through what it is you're going through and who are also involving themselves in what James Baldwin called the agony of creation. You need those people also to be part of your experience and your network. And so if you don't have those people, I do want to encourage you to try to seek them out, either in forms of writers' groups or message boards online or anything like that, where you can have another voice telling you, it's okay, you're still on track, you'll get there, you are talented, you have the ability as long as you can stick with it. That's really important. So for me, identifying the fear that I might let everyone else down, that's really important, because then you can deal with it.
Yeah, I think for me, internally, I'm my own worst enemy in a lot of ways. And what Greg says is absolutely valid, to have somebody else as a springboard and as a, I guess, sort of a mirror, like, no, Kelly, you're being you right now, just take three steps back, you're fine, you know, and then to hash out and talk about it, because all writers are neurotic, we're all insane. And it helps to have a network of people that realize this and can talk you off the ledge whenever those ledges arise. For me, I absolutely have, like, the fear of disappointing people, but what I think one of my bigger fears whenever I'm, like, writing is, like, not doing service to the story, like, I'm not good enough, is my biggest fear. It's like, I am not good enough to pull this shit off. And the plain, simple matter of it is, you know what? You're not good enough to pull it off until you've already pulled it off. Like, you get better at pulling it off by the act of pulling it off.
Mm-hmm.
So how I kind of talk myself off the ledge, if I'm not instantly available, like somebody else isn't instantly available to serve all of my needs, I try and talk to myself like I would talk to somebody else in that same situation. You know, like, I wouldn't dare talk to anyone else how I talk to myself, like, in my bad moments. So I try and take three or four steps back and be like, okay, so what would I say to Greg if he were to call me with this exact sentence? And first of all, I would verbally slap him, and then tell him to get his head out of his ass, and then say, no, this is, you're fine, this is great, you're awesome. And that's what I try and tell myself, and that's how I get over my own fears whenever I go to sit down at a keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so if you couldn't tell already, I'm a bit of a planner. Even though I don't plot the entire novel right up front, I like having plans, I like having schedules in place. The reason that I like having that partially is because if I can get, you know, 1,000 words, 750, 500, whatever, done in a session, that's something quantifiable that I can look at and say I have made progress. When I first started writing, it was kind of catch as catch can. It was certainly not every day. It was, you know, maybe once a week, maybe every other week, and little binge writing. And binge writing works for some people. It does not work for me. And it's really, really daunting. If you think about that 120,000 word mark all the time, and you're at 500, oh, my God, no.
19.5 to go.
So, I mean, so that generates a lot of fear for a lot of people. And if you can break things down, I mean, and also these are big books, so I broke them down into two parts. Partially because I wanted to pay homage to Tolkien, and partially because it helped me to have, you know, I have finished half of this novel at this point. That is pretty cool. I've finished part one. So, and Greg mentioned, you know, breaking things down into bite-sized chunks as well. So that's a big key for me. And then, you know, we talked about kind of backtracking and, you know, taking a little bit of time off and stuff like that. When you do that, allow yourself to actually do it. And what I mean by that is sometimes you may take time off and brainstorm and not write. Other times they may get just overwhelming and life happens. You know, let life happen. If you're taking time off just because it's become too overwhelming, don't say, I'm going to relax. I'm relaxing now because
relaxing?
I have to relax.
Why aren't you relaxing?
So I can get back to
relax.
My writing. Yes. Actually relax. Allow yourself time to get away from the book. This is not life, right? This is a book, and it's something you want to do, granted, but it's not everything. So put it in its place sometimes. Sometimes it gets to be too much, and let it shrink and get back to its normal size. And then the other thing I'm going to touch on is kind of difficult to talk about. There's still, unfortunately, a stigma about it, but some people hit writer's block because, not of fear, but because of depression, right?
Yeah,
and this is not something to do necessarily with writing, but I think in the writing world we have maybe a higher than average, or it seems to me, you know, the creative sort can be predisposed to depression.
Absolutely.
So my urge, it's I know it's difficult, but A, try to recognize the warning signs if you don't already. Just go and look. It's good to know anyway as a writer, correct? And then if you feel like you need it, please, you know, get some help.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. And do not believe that depression is some kind of a stand-in for artistic expression, you know,
yeah,
that,
like
that,
a badge of
that
honor.
I'm sitting in my room and I'm Balzac, you know, and like, yeah. and this is that's nonsense.
Like you're this tortured writer.
It's nonsense because there are, and on a very serious note, we have lost writers who felt that way. I would rather have those artists, musicians, writers, etc., still with us than the ones who did that out of some misguided belief that they were expressing some larger purpose. They're not. It's not worth having your own life affected by it. So what Brad says about putting it all in its proper place is extremely true. And by the way, it will make you a better writer if it is a context within which you write aspects of your life and doesn't become your life itself. You are a better writer because you are better able to express the living lives of people in your books who, thank God, are mostly not writers.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm just going to do like a little ending statement here. I think the biggest thing to like kind of get yourself over a hump or over writer's block or whatever is to remember why you're doing it. Remember what drives you to be a writer. Remember why you love it and remember how much fun you have when you're writing, and that can help. Mm-hmm. So we're at 10 till. Does anybody have any questions?
We do.
We have a few. Okay, Strike Search.
So how do you deal with the allure of the shiny new idea that's totally unrelated to what you're talking about right now?
Yeah, that's a problem.
That's, well, hold that up, please. That's what that's for.
Yeah. This is where you keep your shiny new ideas, and it's true. I have had that experience where I'm in the middle of something, and I'm like, wait, this is an even cooler idea. There's always an even cooler idea. This is the good place to keep those things. It's a repository. One of the things that people sometimes fear is that, well, if I put that in this journal and I come back to it, I won't remember what was so cool about it. Here's a clue. If it wasn't, if you come back to it and you don't really remember what was so cool about it,
it wasn't that cool.
If you look at it, you'll see, oh my God, I remember when this was the case. Do not get into the thought that there's sort of a that you drain your creativity entirely and then it's gone. It doesn't really work that way. Creativity feeds on itself. If you have other things that you've written, you should, after you finish a big project, take a few days to celebrate and relax and all that. But when you come back to that idea that's sitting in it, you're still going to remember what was so exciting about it, and you'll have the benefit of, and I've already got this too. That's the most amazing thing to me, is when you're like, I have this project that's done and I'm out there and I'm querying it or I'm doing whatever and I'm working on this new thing, but I still get to have this other cool thing where I can be like, even if this is not, you know, slow or whatever, I'm like, but look at this that I finished. So yeah, this is the best thing to do.
And the other thing that I like to do that is because I write fairly complex political scope stories, and I just if I write them just from idea of going forward, they can feel immature sometimes. So now I like to, as I get ideas, generate them and let them germinate, yeah. Let them marinate. And so when I get to my next series or novel or whatever, they come out much more mature.
Yep.
So it's awesome to just put those away and you know, from time to time, when you're taking that time off, you know, you just play with those ideas and they start to coagulate a little bit and form.
Absolutely. Yes?
This is kind of a random question, so I hope it makes sense. Like a lot of times, an idea that I have will start with an event instead of a character.
Sure.
And if you work backwards from that, I never end up feeling like the characters that I create then are people. They are more like machines whose motivations I have assigned because I need them to bring about this event.
Yeah,
so you're like a plot-driven writer as opposed to a character-driven writer?
I am a character-driven writer, but I will have a plot-driven idea, and then I will have to have a character to bring about that idea.
Well,
and it never feels natural. It always feels like I made that character from the focus group.
Yeah, I think the key I've run into that too before, and I think the key is to remember what Greg was talking about with the outlines. You know, don't force yourself into that box. You know, and so what I've seen happen with me is that I have this event and I'm working towards, and I often do that for my plotting in general. I work towards something, and sometimes it can feel linear, and I'm the puppet master. These people aren't real, and so as they become more real, because they aren't very fully formed in the beginning, I let things change. You know, that initial spark is often not the same thing. It's close, you know, it's kind of, but I let it conform to the characters as they become more fully realized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of it is just really considering the characters and plot as constantly in a symbiotic relationship, characters that shape the world that shapes the characters. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, you know, as your characters become more fully formed, they will change and alter the original idea you had, but you want that, and the idea will in turn reshape them. So rather than thinking of how do I insert the following, tall guy, shorter, you know, tall male, shorter female, put them together in this. This one looks like this. That one looks like that. You know, rather than thinking of it that mechanically, think about the way that each aspect sort of informs the other. And as you write through, which means you'll have to maybe let your really, really cool idea be shifted a little bit. But the benefit is that you'll be writing something much more realistic, because in history, too, people shape events as much as they are shaped by them. So that symbiotic relationship can help you if you don't think of who do I put in to do my plot, but rather who do I put in this world that will both shape and be shaped by it.
I am sorry, we are out of time. We need to clear the room so we can get people in.
This is the last panel.
Oh, it's the last panel.
Oh,
all right.
All right.
Thank you all very, very much for everything.
Thank you
very much. And if you have tickets, please bring them forward, please.
Bring them up.